with a Russian emissary because Goldstone, conveying a message from Aras Agalarov, had promised them secret Russian information on Clinton. But there was nothing here that could be used against Clinton. Veselnitskaya pressed ahead with a lecture on the Magnitsky Act and how Browder had fabricated key details about what had happened to his company in Russia. Kushner emailed an assistant. Can you please call me on my cell? Need excuse to get out of meeting. Trump Jr. later claimed that he interrupted Veselnitskaya and gently suggested that questions about the Magnitsky Act could be revisited once his father was elected. Toward the end of this 20 to 30 minute session, Akhmetshin could see it had gone south, and he sought to bail out his friend. The Trump camp should focus on the adoption controversy, he said. This could be a great campaign issue, he suggested. Americans want to adopt babies from Russia, and many who do were conservative and religious, exactly the audience that would be supportive of Trump's candidacy. His effort went nowhere. Trump Jr. and the others did not seem to care much about Russian adoptions. They couldn't wait to get out of there, Akhmetshin later told investigators. After the meeting, Kushner texted Manafort, waste of time. Though the meeting might have been a bust for the Trump intimates, it established a connection of sorts between the Trump campaign and Moscow. And Trump's senior advisors now had new reason to believe that Putin's regime wanted Trump to win and was willing to act clandestinely to boost his chances. The campaign did not report this private Russian outreach to the FBI or any U.S. government agency. It's not illegal to listen, Trump Jr. later said. Russian government officials could well have interpreted that as a signal that Trump would not mind or protest if Moscow took other actions to benefit the Republican candidate. The Russians had offered to help, and Trump's campaign had demonstrated a willingness to take what Moscow had to offer. In early June, State Department officials huddled around their computers to watch an astonishing video that had just arrived from Moscow. It captured a violent attack outside one of the entrances to the U.S. Embassy compound. An embassy officer was dropped off by a taxi. Seconds later, a uniformed FSB guard jumped out of a booth, grabbed the American, and slammed him to the ground. A few feet from the door to the complex, the American struggled to break free, but the Russian remained on top of him, pinning the American to the concrete. It took the U.S. officer about 20 seconds to squirm, kick, and struggle his way to the entrance. When the door automatically opened, he managed to position his feet against a side wall and, using all his strength, pushed his way through the door with the FSB man still on top of him. He eventually escaped the guard's grip and was safe on American soil. But his shoulder was broken, and he soon was flown out of the country to receive medical attention. Secretary of State John Kerry watched the video aboard a plane flying back to Washington and was furious. When Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland and her staff viewed it at Foggy Bottom, they were in disbelief. Everybody that saw it was horrified, recalled one official. It brought this to a new level where we had to do a public response. The video clearly depicted an unprovoked attack on compound property and was an outright violation of international law prohibiting local nationals from entering diplomatic property without permission. Kerry contacted Lavrov to complain. The Russians were claiming this American had tried to run away from a security checkpoint or that the American had assaulted the FSB guard. The video did not show any of that. This was unacceptable, Kerry told Lavrov. The minute-long episode seemed the culmination of years of escalating harassment of U.S. diplomats in Russia. The breaking into of apartments, the defacement of property, the FSB tails on their families. Yet there was an awkward problem regarding how to respond. The assaulted American was officially listed as a U.S. diplomat, but he was actually a CIA officer. He had lost his FSB tail while out and about in Moscow, and the Russians had clobbered him to teach him a lesson. The conventions of diplomacy and espionage compelled nations to not acknowledge a well-known secret. Governments routinely granted diplomatic cover to their intelligence officers overseas, and these spies worked out of embassies. Raising a public ruckus and slapping a serious punishment on Moscow for this egregious and violent breach of norms and international law would call attention to CIA activity in Russia. Still, the incident triggered an internal debate within Obama's national security team. Hardliners, including Victoria Nuland and Celeste Wallander, who were backed up by Vice President Joe Biden, believed it was finally time to stand up to Putin. Nuland had a saying about the Russians, "They're going to keep punching until they hit bone." She began developing options for a forceful response. She wanted to expel Russian diplomats, many of whom doubled as spies, and shut down one of two sprawling dachas the Russians used as a retreat for their diplomats in the U.S. The one Nuland targeted, on the eastern shore of Maryland, had been transformed into a giant intelligence collection post. The building had kept expanding over the years, with chimneys erected on the roof that U.S. officials suspected were disguising electronic listening posts aimed at picking up signals along shipping lines into the U.S. naval base at Norfolk. Two units Nuland had set up in the State Department's Europe Division, the Russia Information Group, which tracked Russian disinformation, and the Malign Influence Group, which concentrated on Russian covert actions, circulated more creative ideas aimed at exposing Russian disinformation campaigns. One proposal was to cut U.S. government contracts with Kaspersky Lab, a Russian cybersecurity firm whose founder, Eugene Kaspersky, had graduated from a KGB academy. But Susan Rice, Obama's national security advisor, was not on board. "If you egg the Russians on, this will escalate," Rice argued during an NSC conference call. As angry as he was, Kerry, too, did not favor a harsh reaction. He was not eager to advertise the U.S. Embassy was a base of CIA operations, and he was striving to hammer out a deal with Lavrov to end the horrific Syrian civil war, an effort that some officials within his own department increasingly viewed as a fool's errand. This debate exposed a fault line within the Obama administration over how to deal with Russia. The argument this time was over a single act of Russian harassment. Yet, within months, administration officials would be at odds in a similar way over a much graver and more consequential Russian attack. Chapter 10. WikiLeaks has a very big year ahead. A wave of apprehension, almost panic, swept through the Democratic National Committee's Capitol Hill headquarters on the afternoon of Friday, June 10th. The entire staff of more than 100 employees was ordered into the Lew Wasserman conference room at 4 p.m. sharp. Attendance was mandatory, no interns or guests allowed. Many staffers assumed they were about to be the victims of a mass firing, part of a widely anticipated takeover of the DNC by the Clinton campaign, a move that would be in keeping with the transition that routinely occurs when a candidate becomes the presumptive nominee. Instead, Lindsey Reynolds, the chief operating officer, delivered a sobering but cryptic message to the standing room only crowd about something else. A few weeks earlier, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, had publicly said that unnamed foreign actors were targeting both political parties, and he had cautioned campaigns to be on guard. In light of this warning, Reynolds told the group, the DNC had to update its computer security system. Everybody was to turn in their laptops and devices immediately, no exceptions, and nobody could use their DNC email until further notice. "Take the weekend off," she told them. and don't breathe a word of this to anybody. She added, you can't tell your friends, you can't tell your mother, you can't tell your dog. The staff was baffled. Hand in all devices and take the weekend off at the height of campaign season? Something had to be going on. But Alexandra Chalupa, the DNC consultant tracking Manafort, had no doubt what was happening. The DNC had been breached. It was the Russians, she told her colleagues. In the weeks since CrowdStrike had detected the break-in and confirmed that the FBI warnings had been accurate, the cybersecurity firm had been working feverishly to expel the intruders and secure the DNC's system without tipping off the hackers. DNC officials wanted to be sure that no mention of Reynolds's directive would go through a DNC email because that might alert the Russians. The job was being completed this weekend. The DNC also had brought in outside consultants to plot a PR strategy for handling the news of the hack. They had decided it would be best to go public rather than have the story leak out. And it didn't hurt that the story would advance a narrative that benefited the Clinton campaign and the Democrats. The Russians were interfering in the U.S. election, presumably to assist Trump. Going public about the breach was a dicey move. CrowdStrike's experts had determined that the Russians encrypted files before swiping them from the DNC's computers. They could tell the hackers had targeted the DNC's opposition research folders, but no one at CrowdStrike or the DNC was quite sure what else the hackers had pilfered. And there was the question, what would the Russian intruders do with the DNC files? Were they only spying on the DNC, or would they release and leak material and use it against the Democrats? And if the DNC had no idea what had been stolen, it would be almost impossible to prepare for what might lay ahead. In one of the PR strategy sessions, Luis Miranda, the DNC communications chief, posed a question. What do we say when people ask if this is the biggest political burglary since Watergate? Don't worry, someone said. Nobody will ask that. On June 14th, the Washington Post, which had been briefed on the breach by the DNC and CrowdStrike, broke the news with a front-page story headlined, Russia Government Hackers Penetrated DNC, Stole Opposition Research on Trump. The article by Ellen Nakashima was a true bombshell, reporting that Russian hackers had so thoroughly compromised the DNC's system that they also were able to read all email and chat traffic. The story noted that Russian cyber spies had also targeted the Clinton and Trump campaigns. The depth of the penetration reflects the skill and determination of the United States' top cyber adversary as Russia goes after strategic targets, from the White House and State Department to political campaign organization, Nakashima wrote. But the article was incomplete. The DNC, according to Nakashima's report, maintained that no important financial or personal information had been stolen. This would soon be proven wrong. And the story cited DNC leaders saying they were tipped off to the hack in late April. When we discovered the intrusion, we treated it like the serious incident it is and reached out to CrowdStrike immediately, DNC Chair Wasserman Schultz told the newspaper. The DNC officials, though, did not disclose that their IT department had been informed by the FBI of a possible breach 7 months earlier. The Post story did include a response from the Kremlin. Not surprisingly, the Russians denied everything. I completely rule out the possibility that the Russian government or the government bodies have been involved in this, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, said. The Post described the intrusions as traditional espionage, an attempt by Russian intelligence services to understand the policies, strengths, and weaknesses of a potential future president, much as American spies gather similar information on foreign candidates and leaders. That was how the penetration was initially seen within the Obama White House. Its senior national security officials hardly viewed this break-in as an emergency or anything out of the ordinary. Susan Rice knew Moscow and Beijing habitually tried to hack government and non-government entities. To her, this seemed like the usual cyber espionage, secret snooping with the intent to collect bits of information on the potential next president. Not fundamentally different from what American spies try to do all the time. But there were warning signs in the initial revelation to signal this might be something more than that. After the Post article hit, CrowdStrike released a report entitled Bears in the Midst, identifying the two sets of Russian state hackers, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, as the intruders. The presence of Fancy Bear, the group of cyber actors associated with the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service, was a red flag. In recent years, there had been an increase in aggressive Fancy Bear attacks that went beyond standard espionage. Fancy Bear hackers, using the same implants and malware as had been discovered inside the DNC, had a history of creating phony online personas, with such names as Cyber Caliphate and Anonymous Poland, that stole data and then leaked it to the public. In June 2014, it had penetrated the Ukrainian Central Election Commission's network, destroying data and posting fake election results on its website. In February 2015, it had launched a ferocious attack that seized control of the computer system of TV5 Monde, a major French television network, shutting down its broadcasting channels. For this assault, the Fancy Bear hackers had posed as ISIS terrorists whose images suddenly popped up on TV5 Monde's website. These were not acts of espionage. They were nasty Russian influence operations aimed at demoralizing and confusing the target audience. After the DNC hack was revealed, there was immediate speculation on the blogs of cybersecurity firms. Was this what the Russian hackers were intending? The Trump campaign first responded to the news of the hack by accusing the DNC of committing a hoax. The day after the Post story appeared, 6 days after Trump Jr., Kushner, and Manafort had met with a Russian emissary as part of what they were told was a secret Russian scheme to assist Trump, the Trump campaign issued a statement. We believe it was the DNC that did the hacking as a way to distract from the many issues facing their deeply flawed candidate and failed party leader. In other words, the hacking was not even real. This was the beginning of what would be the Trump camp's refusal to acknowledge the Russians were intervening in the U.S. presidential election. Trump's senior advisors revealed nothing indicating they had recently been told the Kremlin secretly wanted to help Trump become president. The day following the Post story, the leaks began and confirmed the worst fears of cybersecurity researchers who suspected more than espionage was afoot. A hacker going by the name Guccifer 2.0 appeared out of the blue online and took credit for the DNC hack and posted some of the stolen material. The moniker was a reference to the infamous Romanian hacker named Guccifer, who was now in an American prison and who had claimed to have hacked into Clinton's personal email server. He later told the FBI he had not. In a blog post, Guccifer 2.0 mocked CrowdStrike for concluding the job was the work of sophisticated Russian cyber spies. The hacker insisted that he was the one who had filched thousands of documents from the DNC. He posted a DNC opposition report on Trump, which was a long compilation of material already in the public record. Guccifer 2.0 scoffed at DNC chair Wasserman Schultz's claim that no financial documents had been stolen from the DNC and highlighted a spreadsheet of DNC donors. These contributions were a matter of public record. And he published hundreds of other documents, including what appeared to be a planning document from Clinton's early days as Secretary of State. None of the material was stop the presses stuff. But Guccifer 2.0 signed off with an ominous message. The main part of the papers, thousands of files and mails, I gave to WikiLeaks. They will publish them soon. Fuck the Illuminati and their conspiracies. The next day, June 16th, a delegation from the DNC, Amy Dacey, the DNC chief executive, Michael Sussman, the outside lawyer, and CrowdStrike's Sean Henry, entered FBI headquarters for a meeting with Jim Traynor, the assistant FBI director in charge of the Bureau's cyber division. Traynor was an earnest 20-year FBI veteran who had worked in counterintelligence. He had helped handle the illegals case, the Russian spies rolled up by the Bureau 6 years earlier. His calm and friendly demeanor did little to tamp down the simmering tensions at this meeting. Dacey demanded to know why the FBI had not informed top DNC officials earlier and had only interacted with a low-level contractor. "We told the DNC leadership," Traynor responded with a wave of his hand. "I have it in my notes." Dacey bristled. "I don't know who you think the leadership is," she shot back. "The chairwoman, Wasserman Schultz, and I are the leaders, and we weren't notified. We didn't know anything about this." Traynor dismissed her complaint. "I have my reporting on this," he replied. "We're confident about this." But Traynor did confirm CrowdStrike's conclusions. The breach was indeed a Russian hack. The evidence was compelling, he told the DNC delegation. Sussman wanted to know if the Bureau would be willing to state that publicly and put the weight of the FBI behind the CrowdStrike conclusion. The Bureau was cautious in assessing blame in such matters. In the cyber world, attribution was a tricky business. And if the FBI attributed blame, that would mean the U.S. government was leveling a serious accusation, in this case, against a foreign power. This was well above Traynor's pay grade. The FBI didn't do public attributions. "That's a call for the White House," Traynor said. "We'll pass along your request." Guccifer 2.0's reference to WikiLeaks caused some U.S. intelligence officials to suspect there was a Russian connection. WikiLeaks had catapulted to worldwide fame and notoriety 5 years earlier as a pro-transparency and whistleblowing site when it published hundreds of thousands of classified U.S. government documents and State Department cables that had been leaked by an Army intelligence analyst named Bradley Manning. The subsequent dump of these documents infuriated U.S. government officials, none more so than Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who denounced the release as an attack on the international community that had endangered lives and would tear at the fabric of responsible government. Though WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange, were initially hailed by some on the left as courageous truth-tellers, U.S. intelligence officials took a darker view. They suspected there was some sort of link between him and Moscow. In 2012, Assange was given his own show on RT, the Russian government propaganda channel. The next year, he dispatched one of his lawyers to help Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor who stole and leaked thousands of classified documents about U.S. surveillance programs when Snowden fled from Hong Kong to Moscow. In Russia, Snowden was granted asylum by Putin's government, and Assange later took credit for having urged Snowden to head to Moscow. The white-haired, charismatic, and PR-savvy Assange was now a wanted man. Obama's Justice Department had launched a criminal investigation of him for the release of the Manning material. In 2010, Sweden attempted to extradite him from England on sexual assault charges. Assange denied the accusations and claimed this was part of an American plot to silence him. Eventually, he skipped bail and sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in August 2012, and he had been stuck there ever since. Still, Assange regularly gave interviews and issued tweets denouncing U.S. officials, most relentlessly Hillary Clinton. A vote today for Hillary Clinton is a vote for endless, stupid war, he wrote in February 2016. He blamed her for the ongoing mess in Libya, and he added, Hillary's problem is not just that she's a war hawk. She's a war hawk with bad judgment who gets an unseemly emotional rush out of killing people. She shouldn't be let near a gun shop, let alone an army, and she certainly should not become president of the United States. As did Putin, Assange seemed to carry a grudge against the woman who was about to become the Democratic presidential nominee. In early June, Assange had appeared via a video link at a Moscow conference and lambasted Clinton. He was intent on stopping her, and this was no secret. Days later, right before the DNC breach became public, he told a British interviewer, We have upcoming leaks in relation to Hillary Clinton. WikiLeaks has a very big year ahead. In the weeks after the initial dump, Guccifer 2.0 would post much more material. The caches included personal information on DNC donors, fundraising documents from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Democratic outfit known by its abbreviation DCCC and focused on House races, internal records from the Clinton campaign, and emails from the Clinton Foundation. The load also included Clinton campaign memos outlining possible responses to political attacks against Clinton. Guccifer 2.0 revealed the DNC plans for the counter-convention it intended to hold in response to the GOP convention in Cleveland in mid-July. There were thousands and thousands of pages. In blog posts and tweets, Guccifer 2.0 taunted Clinton, the Democrats, CrowdStrike, and other cyber sleuths. The hacker insisted he was a man from Romania. I've never met a female hacker of the highest level. He cited Assange and Snowden as modern heroes. He referred to Clinton as a bought and sold phony, and Trump as sincere in what he says, though he denounced Trump's throw-em-out immigration policy. The insular and global world of cybersecurity techies immediately zeroed in on Guccifer 2.0. Who was he, really? Matt Tate, a 20-something-year-old British-based cybersecurity researcher who tweeted anonymously under the handle @PwnAllTheThings, was initially skeptical that Guccifer 2.0 was a Russian creation, or that the entire hack had been directed from Moscow. But he dug into the metadata of the DNC documents being released by Guccifer 2.0 and noticed that they had been opened in a program using the Russian language option. Then he spotted another clue. The username of one of the computers employed by the hackers contained a reference to Felix Dzerzhinsky, a Soviet revolutionary who had created Lenin's secret police, the forerunner of the KGB, and later the FSB. And he noted the quality of Guccifer 2.0's English varied greatly, suggesting this was a collective persona, not an individual. That convinced Tate. It was indeed the Russians. On Twitter, where various cybersecurity mavens were trading thoughts and theories about the DNC hack, Tate tweeted, LOL, Russian hashtag OPSEC fail. Another cyber intelligence expert, Thomas Ridd, a professor at King's College in London, soon uncovered a damning clue. He had followed Russian hacking for years. One episode he had studied closely was the penetration of the German parliament in May 2015, an attack German intelligence had attributed to the Russians. He knew that another researcher had identified the malware implants used in the German penetration and had posted that computer code online. CrowdStrike had done the same for the DNC breach. For a cybersecurity detective, finding a malware implant is akin to a police officer discovering a gun or set of burglar's tools at a crime scene. Ridd wrote a program that could search both sets of data. He quickly had a hit, a command and control IP address used in the cyber attack against the Bundestag had also been used in the DNC operation. Here was more proof. This evidence also tied the DNC break-in to other Russian hack attacks, including those against NATO, Georgia, and a human rights group in Syria. For Ridd, Tate, and other experts, the case was strong that the Russians were behind both the hack and the dumps, but so far, the U.S. government had said nothing. The DNC hack and the Guccifer 2.0 releases were yet one more headache for the Clinton campaign. By June, Clinton had essentially vanquished Sanders after a long and bitter primary battle. But it wasn't quite over. The Sanders campaign was hinting at extending the nomination contest by trying to convince party officials to dump Clinton and vowing a fight over the party platform. Clinton and her aides needed to find a way to win over Sanders voters embittered with the Democratic establishment after watching their maverick candidate defeated by a party favorite many of them considered a corporate shill. In the middle of coping with all these challenges, Mook ordered the establishment of a working group within the campaign to handle these Guccifer 2.0 releases. Glenn Kaplan, a young New York political operative who specialized in research and communications, was put in charge. His brief on the campaign was to handle what he called the dumpster fires. He had spent much of the last year dealing with the Benghazi and email server controversies. His people combed through each release of the DNC documents looking for damaging material and fielded the flood of queries from reporters. Mook was worried that the DNC breach would spell deeper problems. In response to the DNC hack, the campaign had publicly declared its computer system had not been compromised. But Hillary for America had submitted data to a DNC analytics program that had been penetrated. Mook instructed campaign officials not to discuss this. If word got out that any Clinton campaign data had been compromised by the DNC hack, it could create the impression that the campaign itself had been infiltrated and that her operation was not competent. Worse, talk of any penetration of the Clinton campaign could be conflated with the allegations regarding Clinton's use of a personal email server and fuel the speculation that Clinton's private email server had been breached. Clinton was due to be questioned soon by the FBI in this ongoing probe. Mook was hoping to keep the campaign far from the DNC hack fallout. For Clinton and her aides, there was no question about what was going on. The Russians were meddling in the election to influence its outcome. This was a Russian plot to get Trump elected. "We believed this to our core," Kaplan later said. In early June, while giving a speech on national security, Clinton had ripped into Trump for praising dictators like Vladimir Putin. She added, "I'll leave it to the psychiatrists to explain his affection for tyrants." Now, she did not know if there was a direct connection between Trump's kind words for Putin and the DNC hack, but she and her aides suspected as much. With the releases of the stolen material, Clinton and her advisors became more convinced they were the targets of a Russian operation far more serious than cyber espionage. Was it personal? Was Putin gunning for her? Clinton told aides she believed that the Russians saw her as the frontrunner and were looking to destabilize the election. The Clintonites devised a strategy for shaping the story. This was not about the documents coming out, they told reporters. This was about Russia interfering in U.S. democracy. Asked by journalists about the DNC hack and the released material, Kaplan and other campaign aides refused to discuss details of the documents Guccifer 2.0 was dumping. They kept insisting the Russians were responsible for the DNC hack and were bent on influencing the outcome of the presidential race. Political reporters, not surprisingly, focused on the juicy tidbits flowing out every few days. For many journalists, the campaign line seemed like self-serving spin. The Guccifer 2.0 releases, even if the material was not explosive, did start to move the needle inside the White House. The Russian operation was now more than routine cyber espionage. Never before in an American election had hacked political material been weaponized this way. Clearly, the hackers and Guccifer 2.0 were out to damage a major presidential candidate. This was a new form of high-tech information warfare. At the White House, a trio of Obama's most senior aides, Rice, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough, and Homeland Security Advisor Lisa Monaco, took charge of the administration's response. An order was sent to the intelligence community. Tell us what's going on here. The president wanted to know more. Obama and his top aides had been observing Trump's comments about Russia and Putin for months and had found them confounding. Now, with this cyber attack, probably initiated by Russia, his top aides were much more concerned. Deliberations within the White House about the matter were closely held, much more so than with other sensitive topics. Obama and his senior people did not bring other national security staffers into the discussions. There were cryptic conversations about what was going on and whether at any point we would attribute it to the Russians, a White House official recalled. Within weeks, the DNC hack story fizzled out. The documents Guccifer 2.0 published had no major and direct influence on the campaign. The same was true for another website called DCLeaks.com, which was also releasing stolen emails. But a big problem remained for the campaign. Mook and other Clinton aides had good reason to suspect there was more to come. As Kaplan's research team pored over Guccifer 2.0 releases, it had discovered that the caches included documents that did not originate with the DNC. One of these was a memo sent from Mark Elias to Podesta, Mook, and Dennis Cheng, the campaign finance director. The memo itself was mundane, involving a fundraising legal technicality, but the campaign could find no sign that the document had ever been circulated within the DNC computer network. It seemed most likely it had been purloined from Podesta's email account. No one yet knew Podesta's email had been fully compromised, but top Clinton officials now feared there could be other dumps, and not just from the DNC. Podesta's role as campaign chairman was to oversee the organization and manage the often competing elements of the unwieldy and conflict-ridden community of Clinton friends, allies, consultants, and hangers-on. His emails would include documents from the heart of Clinton world with headline-worthy material that might derail their efforts. Yet, the Clinton aides concluded there was little they could do about this. I didn't take 6 weeks off to review the 60,000 emails in my inbox, Podesta later said. But every time Guccifer 2.0 released a new batch, the campaign searched for Podesta material. There was a constant fear that something big would happen, Shane Habel, the campaign's chief information officer, recalled. Every day we wondered if this will be the day it hits. We just kept on waiting for whatever it would be. Chapter 11. I have to report this to headquarters. Early in June, two men met for lunch at an Italian restaurant in Terminal 5 of London's Heathrow Airport. They shared a deep passion, uncovering and countering the corruption and misdeeds of Putin's regime. On one side of the table was Christopher Steele, the British spy who had handled the Litvinenko case a decade earlier. In his early 50s, Steele still looked the part, a dapper dresser with pale blue eyes and a somber, no-nonsense demeanor. Across the table was Glenn Simpson, a tall, scruffy American with an intense manner. They were kindred spirits, each fixated on the machinations of the Kremlin. The 52-year-old Simpson had once been a renowned investigative journalist at the Wall Street Journal. One of his specialties was scoops revealing that powerful Russian oligarchs and organized crime figures had hired Washington lobbyists and lawyers to exert influence in the nation's capital. In 2009, He had quit the paper to form a modest-sized private investigative and research service in Washington. The firm, which he later named Fusion GPS, handled jobs for political and corporate clients in the United States and abroad, always under the cloak of secrecy. Simpson once described what his company did as journalism for rent. It often was hired by corporations entangled in bitter regulatory or legal disputes, such as Herbalife, a supplement company accused of essentially being a pyramid scheme, and Theranos, a healthcare tech startup that issued questionable claims about its pioneering blood testing technology. The firm's mission often was to ward off damaging media stories and investigate the critics of its controversial clients. In 2012, Fusion GPS was hired to do opposition research on Mitt Romney for Barack Obama's re-election campaign. As had become standard practice in the shadowy world of Oppo research, the Obama campaign's payments to Fusion GPS were never publicly disclosed. The money paid to the investigative firm was reported on campaign disclosure reports as legal bills to the campaign's law firm, Perkins Coie. More recently, Fusion GPS had assisted an American law firm defending Previazon, the Russian-owned company accused in the United States of laundering money stolen from investor Bill Browder. This was the case that spurred Congress to pass the Magnitsky Act, the law imposing sanctions on Russian officials engaged in human rights abuses. Simpson's job was to dig up material that could be used to discredit Browder. In an odd twist of fate, this had placed Simpson and his firm on the same side as Natalia Veselnitskaya, the Russian attorney who represented Previazon and who had been sent by the Agalarovs to meet with Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner in Trump Tower. But even still, Simpson had maintained his focus on Putin's mafia state. I had an interest, bordering on an obsession, with Russian kleptocracy and organized crime, he later said. On such matters, Steele was the man to see. Steele was no longer with British intelligence, but he was still in the spy business, as a private contractor. While in MI6, Steele had become friendly with a high-ranking colleague named Chris Burrows, who specialized in counterterrorism. In 2009, they each left MI6 and did what many spies do. They entered the private intelligence business. Together, they formed a firm called Orbis Business Intelligence, which was designed to capitalize on Steele's vast knowledge of Russia and the interrelationships there between business and politics. On its website, Orbis boasted, "Our core strength is our ability to meld a high-level source network with a sophisticated investigative capability. We provide strategic advice, mount intelligence-gathering operations, and conduct complex, often cross-border investigations." Steele and Burroughs were spies for hire. Steele was the heart of the operation, Burroughs its salesman. Steele, who possessed a phenomenal memory, was a master of vacuuming up huge amounts of information and analyzing material. His recollection of facts is absolute, Burroughs later observed. That is his intellectual gift. Burroughs, though, believed himself better at intuition, at understanding sources and assessing their motives and credibility. One of the firm's assets that Burroughs pitched to clients was Steele's deep understanding of how the Russians used kompromat, compromising information usually obtained through furtive means, as a weapon in politics, diplomacy, and business. Right away, Orbis was a success, in part because it did far more than spit out reports based on public record data searches, which was the mainstay of many of its competitors. It conducted operations, much as spy services did. In one case, the company was hired by a British insurance company operating in Russia that was being harassed by Russian tax collectors. Steele discovered the reason. The son of the chief Russian regulator had a rival business, so he put in motion an operation. Through his contacts, Steele let it be known to senior Russian officials that if the harassment did not stop, word about this would be spread to other multinational companies, threatening future investments in the region. The harassment stopped. This, Burroughs recalled proudly, was covert influence. In 2010, Steele and Burroughs landed a major assignment to support the English Football Association's bid to host the Soccer World Cup in 2018. It was an intensely competitive process. Senior British officials and Prince Charles were directly involved in lobbying FIFA, the International Soccer Federation, for the tournament. At the same time, the Obama administration was pushing for the U.S. to be awarded the 2022 World Cup. When FIFA selected Russia for 2018 and Qatar for 2022, the Brits and the Americans were outraged and convinced the decision was the result of corruption that included payoffs. Steele had picked up intelligence that Putin was using friendly oligarchs to slip bribes to FIFA board members. "We had a burning sense of injustice," Steele recalled. "This was the most corrupt international organization in the world." He rang up an FBI agent named Mike Gaeta, whom he had recently met at a conference in Oxford. Gaeta specialized in Russian organized crime and was then assigned to the New York field office. "I have got some material I'd like to show you," Steele told him. Gaeta was interested, and soon Steele was flying to the United States for meetings with FBI officials in New York and Washington, D.C., to share intelligence he had collected about the unsavory connections of various FIFA officials. He gave the FBI intelligence reports that amounted to a dossier on FIFA corruption. One especially damning piece of evidence was a 2005 photograph Steele had uncovered showing Sepp Blatter, the longtime FIFA president, laughing and clinking glasses at a Moscow nightclub with Alimjan Takhtakhunov, the alleged Russian organized crime boss known as the Little Taiwanese. Takhtakhunov was on the Bureau's most wanted list, a fugitive from U.S. justice who had been indicted in 2002 for allegedly scheming to fix the Winter Olympics figure skating competition that year to ensure a gold medal for Russia. The indictment was announced by James Comey, then a U.S. attorney. Takhtakhunov would be indicted again in 2013 for allegedly protecting a high-stakes transatlantic gambling ring, which operated in Trump Tower and laundered tens of millions of dollars for Russian oligarchs through shell companies in Cyprus. Steele's reports helped spur a wide-ranging, years-long investigation that ultimately led to multiple indictments against FIFA figures by federal prosecutors in Brooklyn. Blatter wasn't charged, but he was forced to resign. Steele had established himself as a trusted source for the FBI. He soon did the same with the U.S. State Department. In the spring of 2014, Steele, retained by a private business client, was producing reports on the Ukrainian crisis. He thought they might be of interest to Washington and reached out to Jonathan Weiner, a senior official at Foggy Bottom who once had done lobbying work for Mikhail Khodorkovsky, an exiled Russian oligarch and Putin foe. Weiner notified Victoria Nuland that he had a source with good contacts in Russia and Ukraine. Would she be interested? "Yes," she said, and after reviewing a few of Steele's reports, she told Weiner to keep them coming. But Nuland, concerned that the material could be intercepted by Russian hackers, asked Weiner to first place them into a secure State Department classified computer system before forwarding them to her. Between May 2014 and February 2016, Steele sent Nuland 120 Orbis reports about political and diplomatic developments in Russia and Ukraine. The memos covered efforts to evade the Western sanctions and activities of various oligarchs. The material, which included information on Russian plans and intentions, seemed generally on the mark, Nuland thought. His stuff was 75% to 80% accurate, she later said. At times, I thought he had gotten spun up by a source, but in general, they were congruent with what I was seeing. By the spring of 2016, Steele was now deemed a valuable supplier of intelligence to two agencies of the U.S. government, the FBI and the division of the State Department in charge of Russia policy. For years, Fusion and Orbis had cooperated on various ventures, and in the Heathrow Airport, Simpson explained that he had a new assignment for Steele, should he choose to accept it. Simpson and his firm had been investigating Donald Trump for months. Initially, his client for this project was the Washington Free Beacon, a conservative website funded by billionaire hedge fund kingpin Paul Singer, a lucrative Fusion GPS client. The website and Singer had been part of the conservative Never Trump movement that aimed to prevent the mogul from bagging the Republican nomination. Now, that was essentially a lost cause, and they saw no reason to keep paying Simpson to conduct opposition research on Trump. But Simpson had wanted to keep the Trump project going, and so he and his partner, another former Wall Street Journal reporter named Peter Fritsch, had pitched Mark Elias, the Democratic lawyer who served as both the chief counsel for the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. In April, Elias and Simpson worked out a deal. Fusion GPS would be retained by Elias's firm, Perkins Coie, with the investigators' fees and expenses paid by the Clinton campaign and the DNC. Once again, the arrangement would be obscured on campaign disclosure reports filed with the Federal Election Commission. The payments to Fusion GPS were reported as legal fees to the law firm. Over time, more than $1 million in Hillary for America and DNC funds would be paid to Fusion GPS. Yet many of the top officials at the Clinton campaign and the DNC were not aware of the arrangement and what Fusion GPS was up to. When months later, Donna Brazile, then the DNC chair, picked up rumors about the firm's research in Russia, she confronted Elias and demanded an explanation. He brushed her off, according to Brazile, and said, "You don't want to know." It was ironic that Simpson was the Clinton campaign's chief undercover oppo man. He had no sympathy for Clinton or most of the people around her, starting with her husband. Simpson had spent a good chunk of his career as a journalist investigating the Clintons. In 1996, Simpson broke big stories about the flood of foreign money from China, Indonesia, and elsewhere that poured into Democratic Party coffers to boost Bill Clinton's 1996 re-election campaign. In his first front-page piece on the subject, Simpson and co-author Jill Abramson wrote that the Asian cash flow highlights a subject that doesn't get much discussion, how foreign influence seeps into the American political system. More recently, Fusion GPS had tracked wealthy foreign donors who had pumped money into the Clinton Foundation in what looked to Simpson to be an effort to influence and win favors from Clinton's State Department. "I had no interest in working for Hillary fucking Clinton," Simpson later said. "I covered these people, Hillary and Bill Clinton, for years. They were an old-fashioned political machine." For Simpson, Trump was now the bigger and more sinister threat. His multiple bankruptcies, his past ties to mob figures, his questionable business dealings that had resulted in repeated lawsuits alleging fraud, all of this alarmed Simpson. But it was Trump's trips to Russia that intrigued him the most. He knew that Trump had gone to Moscow repeatedly, but nothing had ever come of it other than the Miss Universe pageant. "I thought it was mysterious and curious that he kept going there and not getting a deal," Simpson later said. Who had Trump been trying to do business with? What had gone wrong? Simpson asked if Steele would be willing to investigate. His brief to Steele was simple. "Tell me what he's been doing over there." Simpson at this point knew something else that he did not share with Steele during their lunch at Heathrow. As a Democratic Party contractor, He had been briefed on the Russian hack of the DNC, a development that was not yet public. It raised the possibility the Russians might be seeking to influence the election on behalf of Trump. Simpson was not yet at liberty to share what he knew. "I was extremely cagey about what I told him," Simpson recalled. But Simpson was hoping that Steele, whose firm had investigated Russian influence operations in Western Europe, could pick up some intelligence on what the Russians were doing in the election. Steele was game. Orbis had ongoing projects in Russia for clients involved in commercial litigation. He figured he could easily hand this new assignment to his contacts in Russia, whom he paid to search out information and prepare reports. Steele himself was known to the Russians and could not operate there. Simpson and Steele agreed to a 30-day contract, with an option to renew. Steele got in touch with one of his chief sources in Russia, or as he called him, the collector, and instructed him to start seeking information on Trump. Steele guarded the collector's identity as a top secret, but Simpson understood that the collector was a Russian emigre living in the West who traveled frequently to Moscow and was acquainted with well-informed Russian professionals and officials. He was Steele's undercover operative, working his own Russian sources for whatever nuggets they might yield. 2 weeks or so later, Steele flew to meet his chief collector in a European city. As Steele listened and took notes, he could scarcely believe what he was hearing. His collector, relaying what he had been told by his contacts, informed Steele that the Russians had been targeting and cultivating Trump for years and had even gathered kompromat on him, specifically tales of weird sexual indiscretions that the collector said were an open secret in Moscow. "I was horrified," Steele recalled. "I thought I had heard and seen everything in my career. But nothing like this." Steele immediately notified Simpson. He had absolute dynamite, Steele told him, mentioning the sexual kompromat. "I'm going to need a report," Simpson said. "You should write it up." Steele quickly composed a 3-page memo that would become one of the most famous and controversial private intelligence reports of all time. At the top and bottom of each page, Steele typed, "Confidential, sensitive source," and the memo, dated June 20th, began with a 4-point summary. The first point was the broadest one. Russian regime has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Trump for at least 5 years. Aim, endorsed by Putin, has been to encourage splits and divisions in Western alliance. Next, Steele noted, "So far, Trump has declined various sweetener real estate business deals offered him in Russia in order to further the Kremlin's cultivation of him. However, he and his inner circle have accepted a regular flow of intelligence from the Kremlin, including on his Democratic and other political rivals." The third point was potentially the most explosive. "Former top Russian intelligence officer claims FSB has compromised Trump through his activities in Moscow sufficiently to be able to blackmail him. According to several knowledgeable sources, his conduct in Moscow has included perverted sexual acts which have been arranged and/or monitored by the FSB." The final point was about Trump's rival. "A dossier of compromising material on Hillary Clinton has been collated by the Russian intelligence services over many years and mainly comprises bugged conversations she had on various visits to Russia and intercepted phone calls rather than any embarrassing conduct. The dossier is controlled by Kremlin spokesman Peskov directly on Putin's orders. However, it has not as yet been distributed abroad, including to Trump. Russian intentions for deployment, still unclear." In the following 2 pages, Steele went into details. He characterized his collector's sources without naming them. He described Source A as a senior Russia Foreign Ministry official and Source B as a former top Russian intelligence officer still active within the Kremlin. Both had each recently told a trusted compatriot the collector, that Moscow had been running an operation for years to cultivate and co-opt Trump, and that this project was supported and directed by Putin. According to source C,